Chapter 13, The Tonight Show, starring Johnny Carson. Adam Egan has pity all over his face and in his stupid voice. "But I thought you already went to Hollywood to go on that show where they search for stars. But you lost. Just imagine if you had won." "Well, it's like that expression, Adam Egan. Everything happens for a reason." "I've never heard that expression."
"You haven't? It's a very, very famous and popular expression. Women are particularly fond of it."
I don't even know what it means," says Adam Egan. "So everything happens for a reason? I never knew. Everything happens for a reason. So there's some secret reason I ate that bowl of Frankenberries for breakfast?"
"You know something? You make it hard to tell a story. But I will go on. As I was saying, everything happens for a reason," I say, and then I tell my story.
After my Star Search debacle, I stayed in Los Angeles and worked at the Improv, the world-famous Comedy Store, and the Laugh Factory. I had decided to take a break from the road, to try to perfect my material at the L.A. clubs. Every night, I went on stage, and afterward I hung out and talked to the audience, answering their questions, which were always the same. "What is the Bushman like in real life?" "Do you think the Bushman will come here tonight?" "If the Bushman does come here tonight, would you mind taking a picture of him with me?" I met some great comics in Los Angeles, and the best one, and the one who became my friend and hero, was Rodney Dangerfield. Many a night I sat at the back of the Improv, watching Rodney the way a dog watches a man, or a man a god. This guy was the complete package. He looked funny, he talked funny, he even moved funny, tugging at his tie and wiping sweat off his brow. And all the while, his comically bulging eyes shifted nervously from side to side. He wrote the best jokes any comic has ever written. But that's news to nobody. I know another side of Rodney. I've got the inside scoop on big-time celebrities, and one of them is Rodney Dangerfield. Soon after meeting Rodney, when he was at the peak of his career, I learned a very distressing truth. And that truth was that success and money mean nothing when it comes to achieving happiness. From an outsider's perspective, it seemed Rodney had everything. Money, success, fame. But there was one thing Rodney Dangerfield was never able to attain, and it plagued him his entire life. The ugly little secret in Hollywood was that Rodney Dangerfield never got any respect. Now, I know that's hard to believe, but hear me out. Every story Mr. Dangerfield told me was more heartbreaking than the last. It had all started when he was a child, and his father told him that his dying wish was to have little Rodney sit on his lap. I thought it was such an adorable thing for a father to tell his son. I really did. Until Rodney informed me his dad was sitting in the electric chair at the time. Rodney's mother now had to raise the boy alone and decided to get him a dog. But she didn't think the dog would play with a tot such as Rodney unless she tied a pork chop around the boy's neck. Rodney finally grew up and became a man, but things didn't improve. One time, he recalled, a hooker informed him, "Not tonight, I have a headache, okay?" Imagine hearing that from a prostitute. I told Rodney that when I felt the whole world was against me, I'd find a tavern where a bartender would always lend an understanding ear. But Rodney said he tried that once, and that when he asked the bartender for a double, the bartender brought out a guy who looked just like Rodney. Rodney told me story after story, and each had an identical theme. Rodney Dangerfield, famous, wealthy, comedy superstar, just didn't get any respect. No respect at all. Are you kidding me? I suggested a therapist, and a sad look came into Rodney's roomy eyes. He had seen one, yes, and the therapist, and I use the term very loosely, said Rodney was crazy.
Rodney demanded a second opinion, and the cruel psychiatrist told him that he was ugly as well. I felt so bad for my friend and hero. I wanted to tell him how deeply I respected him, both as a man and as an entertainer, but I knew Rodney would only think I was mocking him. Then one night, I got the most frightening phone call of my life. Rodney had begun to feel that perhaps it was his fault that he never received any respect, and, disconsolate, he decided to end it all. He told me over the phone that in a fit of despair, he had swallowed a bottle of sleeping pills. "Rodney," I screamed into the phone, "please listen, you must get to a doctor." "I just left his office, Norm. He told me to have a few drinks, try to get some sleep, all right? Okay." I didn't want to tell Rodney, but I thought that was one of the most disrespectful things I'd ever heard a doctor suggest. But Rodney already knew all too well. When he was away from the spotlight and alone with me, he would tell me his secret truth, all summed up in one sad sentence. "I tell you, Norm, it's a story of my life, all right? I get no respect, no respect at all." And so it went with Rodney Dangerfield. It reminded me of that line in the scriptures, "What doth it profit a man if he gains the whole world, but don't get no respect, no respect at all? Are you kidding me?" I was also pretty down during this time. I felt I'd had my big chance on Star Search and blown it. In my dreams, I often saw the angry eyes of Ed McMahon. But one fateful night, while watching The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson, everything at once became diamond clear to me. My melancholia lifted, and I was overcome with joy and hope. What did I care about Ed McMahon? The world didn't revolve around Ed McMahon. The world revolved around the man sitting to his immediate left every night at 11:30. The king and the kingmaker, Johnny Carson. I knew I had to get on The Tonight Show, and I knew in that moment that I would. I knew deep in my soul that Johnny would make me an overnight star and that it would happen very soon. I drank a handle of bourbon that night, alone and in glory. Late in the fall of 1991, things were different for comedians. Johnny Carson could make your career with a wave of his hand. Here's how it worked. You went out there, you did your 6 minutes, and if Johnny liked you enough, he'd wave his arm, inviting you to join him at his desk, and you'd sit beside him, and he would anoint you, and you would become a star. No other man could do that. Problem was, Carson had already announced his retirement, and my time was running out on being anointed. But every time I went on stage in Los Angeles, my chances of getting on Carson increased, and I was doing as many sets as possible. It was near Christmas when I came off stage at the world-famous Comedy Store and was approached by a small, unassuming man. You can spot a big shot in Hollywood because he wears a pinstripe suit and chews on a fat cigar. He is never unassuming. He's always assuming as hell. "Hi, my name's Jim McCauley, and I'm the talent booker for The Tonight Show," the man said. Hollywood is a town filled with fakes and phonies, charlatans and mountebanks, just waiting to take advantage of a country hick like me. I quickly deduced that this Jim McCauley character was about as authentic as a pound of pimento loaf. So I decided two could play that game. "Is that so? Well, it's sure nice to meet you, Jim. My name's Norm MacDonald, and I'm the King of Spain." The man chuckled nervously. He knew I was on to him, but he continued nonetheless. "As you know, Johnny is retiring in May, and he'd really like to break one last comic on the show. Norm, I think you're the guy." "Well, that sounds fine to me, Jim. As a matter of fact, it's been a dream of mine since I started stand-up. But, of course, I'll have to run it by my wife, the Queen of Spain. I'm sure you understand." He laughed again, but he couldn't give up the act. He was in it too deep. "Okay, then. We'll be in touch." He really slipped up there, because he had said "we," but he was all alone. Fair enough. I'll talk to you guys later, I said. The next morning, I got a call from a lady. Mr. McDonald, I have Jim McCauley for you. Sorry, never heard of him, I said, before hanging up. The phone rang again. Mr. McDonald, I have Mr. McCauley. The man you met last night, the man who books comedians to appear on The Tonight Show? Oh, yes, of course, that Mr. McCauley. Yeah, put him on. I had to admire this guy's persistence. Hi, Norm. I think I found the perfect date. Second week of January, we have Steve Martin and Elton John. I ran it past Johnny, and he thinks it's great, because you'll be performing in front of him and Steve Martin, and fingers crossed, after your set, you'll be sitting right between them. Boy, had this guy done his homework. Steve Martin was my favorite comic, and I always considered Elton John to be a great singer as well as a hot piece of ass. Well, you see, the thing is this, Jim. January is not the perfect month, because that's when the people of Spain are at their most anti-monarchist. And if I was to leave the country at that point, there could be trouble in the streets. I don't know if you follow Spanish politics, Jim, but the Queen is not well liked by her subjects. But what the hell, you only live once. I'll do it. I'll be on The Tonight Show. Oh, congratulations, Norm. I think it's going to be dynamite. Well, a few weeks passed, and I got a panicked call from my agent. Norm, were you supposed to be on the Carson Show tonight? Oh, don't tell me that guy is phoning you now. That guy is Jim McCauley, and he books The Tonight Show, you idiot. Oh, I thought he was just a guy pulling a prank. Tell him I'll do it. I already asked. He said you're dead in his eyes. Boy, I really blew that one. Every comic's dream. I had it in my hand, and I let it sift through my fingers because I didn't know how to trust. I got very angry at myself, and in a rage, I returned to Madrid, where I took it out of my subjects by ruling them with an iron fist.
I first met Mr. McDonald 6 months ago in the Random House offices here in the city. My publisher, Julie Grau, introduced us and informed me that he had a story that simply must be told. I'd heard this same speech from Julie many times before about many different people in that very office. There are so many stories that simply must be told, and it's my job to tell them. Besides, as I said, I was a fan of his back in the 90s and was curious as to what had befallen the man. I had expected that Mr. McDonald and I would hit it off that day. Julie had motioned me into her office that afternoon while Mr. McDonald was telling a story about how he hated Eskimos. It was not so much a story, really, as a string of words that was randomly assembled, incoherent, unending, and filled with hate. Every piece of clothing he wore advertised something he had done in the entertainment business at some time. He may as well have had has-been stenciled on his forehead. I knew I had my work cut out for me with this one. You wouldn't know it now, but I was a great man once, a fine young man, alive with ideas. And suddenly I found myself an old man, standing in a doorway as Mr. McDonald spoke of how he didn't trust Eskimos and never would. I had never felt such instant animus toward anyone. I remember thinking that this time I might not take the job. I might just walk out of the office. But I stayed put as Mr. McDonald mercifully finished his story. And so anyways, the point is, I've never met an Eskimo I liked. Not once, not ever. As a matter of fact, I don't think I've ever even met an Eskimo. I call them blubber eaters, by the way. And don't even get me started on the filthy Swedes. He struck the table with his fist, and Julie burst into laughter. I'd heard many silly celebrities tell their silly stories in my time. They always amused me, the way a harmless child amuses me. But Mr. McDonald appalled me, the way a harmful child appalls me. For the first time, he fixed his sluggard's eyes on me. Who are you, old man? The name's Keene, Mr. McDonald. Terence Keene. I extended my hand, and he shook it with great strength, the way weak men always do. He finally stopped, and I stood there, clasping and unclasping my hand, hoping the brute hadn't broken it in his effort to prove his manhood. I will be your ghostwriter. Mr. McDonald lit up a cigarette in a non-smoking building and shot a look at Julie. Julie, abashed, cast her eyes down. "Oh, yes, Terence. Norm was just explaining to me that he has no need for a ghostwriter, only a secretary." "That's right, mister," said Mr. McDonald. "I'm a great writer. Written sketches, jokes, gags, all kinds of things. A memoir will be nothing for a guy like me. Problem is, I never learned to type. Back when I went to school, very few boys took any typing classes, if you catch my drift. What about you, Keen? Did you ever take any typing classes?" He looked at me with a stupid smirk. Of course I'd caught his drift. It was the kind of drift you'd catch upon entering a gas station restroom. But I wasn't about to be cowed by this bullying clown. "As a matter of fact, I did. Yes. Most useful class I took in high school. I can type 75 words a minute." McDonald looked over at Julie. "I guess he'll do. Although I gotta tell you, when I pictured having a secretary, I figured she'd have a nice set of cans." He then looked to me. "No offense, Keen, but yours look kind of floppy." And then he let out a big hoary laugh, which was followed by Julie's delighted squeal. "Oh, you are incorrigible, Norm. Absolutely incorrigible. Isn't he, Terence?" "Yes," I managed. "A true scapegrace." I just stood there, burning up inside, and I guess Julie noticed, because she stopped laughing and turned to me. "Of course, Terence, the deal would be the same as if you were the ghostwriter, the standard 10% plus. Mr. McDonald will receive $1 million upon receipt of the manuscript, and you will be paid $100,000. That cooled me down considerably, because that was a great deal of money for a celebrity memoir, especially a celebrity who hadn't worked in years. "Wow," Mr. McDonald said. "100K. That's easy money for you, Keen. I'll tell you the stories, and all you have to do is write them down, word for word. That's it. You don't have to add your own opinions. Nobody's interested. If you can type as fast as you claim, we should be able to finish this thing in a week." I looked at him closely to see if he was joking. He wasn't. "I'll tell you what, Mr. McDonald, why don't I begin with a little cursory research on you, and we can get to work presently. I feel this collaboration will work out splendidly, sir. Just splendidly. How does that sound to you?" "It sounds womanish." I beg your pardon?" "I mean the way you say splendidly. Just sounds womanish, that's all. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't care what filthy things a man does with another man when they lay down together, but I just don't want any words like splendidly showing up in this book. You understand me, brother?" His eyes were dull, and he took a menacing step toward me, and I backed up to the door. And in a moment, I was out on the streets of a big, busy city and away from the vile man, and it felt fine. As a matter of fact, it felt splendid. Splendid, splendid, splendidly, 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 splendidly.